All right, good. Is it working? It's working. Hebrews 9. We started this a couple weeks ago before we were rudely interrupted by weather. So we're going to look at the first section again. So I'll read all the way through 1 through 10, verses 1 through 10. Now, the first covenant had regulations for worship in an earthly place of holiness. For a tent was prepared, the first section in which were the lampstand and the table of and the bread of the presence is called the holy place. Behind the second curtain was the second section called the most holy place, having the golden altar of incense, the ark of the covenant covered on all sides with gold, in which was a golden urn holding the manna and the Aaron's staff that budded and the tablets of the covenant. Above it were the cherubim of glory overshadowing the mercy seat. Of these things that we cannot now speak in detail. These preparations having thus been made, the priests go regularly into the first section, performing their ritual duties, but into the second only the high priest goes, and he but once a year, and not without taking blood, which he offers for himself and for the unintentional sins of the people. By this, the Holy Spirit indicates that the way into the holy places is not yet opened as long as the first section is still standing, which is symbolic for the present age. According to this arrangement, gifts and sacrifices are offered that cannot perfect the conscience of the worshiper, but deal only with food and drink and various washings, regulations for the body imposed until the time of reformation. So that's what we'll try to get through this morning. Again, he lays out basically what the tabernacle slant temple looked like. And I think really he's pointing back to a look at the tabernacle. That thing that Moses saw when he was on the mountain that was then the pattern for the tabernacle that was built on the earth. We're going to actually, in the next section, look at the heavenly tabernacle, the one where Jesus actually is supposed to have entered with his blood, a once-for-all offering as he took his blood as the high priest and sprinkled it. But right now, we're contrasting the two. He's laying out, this is how worship kind of was done in the old covenant, and basically what that accomplishes, what this first section is really about, and then he's looking to, so, and then you look at Jesus and what his blood accomplished was something much more significant and much greater, much more superior. So even the sacrifice, Jesus' sacrifice is superior to the sacrifice of the Old Testament, the Old Covenant. And remember, that's what he's doing throughout all of this book, is he's proving the superiority of Jesus over those old things of the Old Covenant. And so this is what 9 really is about, is the superiority of Jesus' sacrifice to those sacrifices in the Old Covenant. And he starts off, we started looking at this as he lays out kind of what the tabernacle looked like, and it's the way it was sectioned. And really what he is doing is he is looking toward the separation and how difficult it was to get to God's presence under the Old Covenant. How it really, in some sense, how inapproachable God was in the Old Covenant. We looked at it the last time. You know, if you understood outside of the tabernacle area, anyone could be there. It was, you know, you could be a Jew, a Gentile. You shouldn't have been a Canaanite, because Canaanites should have all been driven out and eradicated. But any other Gentile and any other Jew, there was no problem living anywhere around outside the tabernacle, not a bit, once it's in Israel. So that's it. But once you went through the main doors into the tabernacle proper area, the courtyard area, only Jews could go in there. Gentiles were excluded. Only Jews and proselytized Gentiles could go in there. Those Gentiles who had actually been circumcised and said, yes, we might not be born Jewish people, but we are taking Jewishness on ourselves and we are living, we're understanding, we're doing the law. And those were proselytized. Those are not called strangers. Those aren't sojourners. Those are believing, God-fearing Jews. There's a difference between those two terms. But once you got into the courtyard, only those could go. Only Jewish people and proselytized Gentiles could go in there. But once you got past the courtyard, so in the courtyard there was the bronze, the altar, you know, where they did the sacrifice, and the laver, where there was cleansing going on. So those were the two pieces of furniture outside in the courtyard that really, again, but only the only people who had access into that to see the altar and the courtyard were Jews and proselytized Gentiles. Once you got past that, then you would go into the tent of the tabernacle. And inside the tent, there were two sections. There was the first section, which was called the holy place. And the holy place had, according to the Old Testament, had three pieces of furniture in it. It had the candlestick, which actually should be referred to as lampstand. Since candles didn't exist yet, there was no such thing as a candle until like the Dark Ages. So there couldn't be a candlestick. That's a mistranslation of the word. The word is lampstand. That's what it is. It was a golden lampstand. There was the table of the bread of the presence, which was where the show bread was, the special bread, 12 loaves, you know, put there. And there was, according to Leviticus, there was then in that section on just at the veil, separated, there was the altar of incense, which represents the prayers of the people of God. It was just there. That was in the holy place. Now, the author of Hebrews says there were only two pieces of furniture in that first section. There was only the lampstand and the table of showbread. He says in his list here, he says, and then you went past the second curtain or the veil, we call it the veil. Inside the veil, according to Leviticus, according to the Old Testament, there was one piece of furniture in two parts. It was the Ark of the Covenant with the mercy seat on top of it. According to our author here in Hebrews, there was the altar of incense and the Ark of the Covenant in there. I talked to you last time and said, I don't know yet. However, I think I've reached a conclusion here, and I may be completely wrong, and I'm not going to debate it with anybody, including him. But there seems to be a difference on the Day of Atonement. It seems as if the altar of incense is inside the Holy of Holies on the Day of Atonement. Look at Leviticus 16. I think that's really what drives me to this. Leviticus 16 is where the Day of Atonement is actually getting introduced to the people and what the high priest is supposed to do with regard to his duties that he's supposed to accomplish. So I'll just read, start at verse 1. The Lord spoke to Moses after the death of his two sons Aaron when they drew near. He says, tell Aaron, your brother, not to come at any time into the holy place inside the veil before the mercy seat that is on the ark, that he may not die. For I will appear in a cloud over the seat, but in this way Aaron shall come into the holy place with a bull from the herd of the sin offering, a ram for a burnt offering. He shall put on the holy linen coat, and he shall tie the linen sash around his waist and wear the linen turban. These are the holy garments. He shall bathe his body in water and put them on, and he shall take from the congregation of the people inside Israel two male goats for a sin offering and one ram for a burnt offering. Try to get where I am. Yeah, I know. I'll just keep reading until I get there. I'll just start at 11. Aaron shall present the bull as a sin offering for himself and shall make atonement for himself and for his house. He shall kill the bull as a sin offering for himself, and he shall take a censer full of coals of fire from the altar before the Lord, and two handfuls of sweet incense beaten small, and shall bring it inside the veil. Okay? So he takes coals and he takes incense, and he takes that where? He takes it inside the veil. So now Aaron is inside the Holy of Holies, the most holy place is where he is. And what does he do, verse 13, with the incense? And put the incense on the fire before the Lord, that the cloud of incense may cover the mercy seat that is over the testimony so that it does not die. So it feels to me like, at least on the Day of Atonement, the altar of incense was placed inside the veil so that Aaron could put that incense on that fire that was burning before the Lord. Because he goes inside the veil, He takes the censer, and then he takes that censer and puts it on the fire that's before the Lord.
Who puts it in?
Well, that's the good question. And the question is, who puts it in? The answer to that could be that God knows when the Day of Atonement is going to be, right? And they know when the Day of Atonement is. It very possibly could be the presence of the Lord lifts for the beginning of that day. They stick the altar of incense by the Levites who are supposed to carry it, put it inside the altar, put it inside the holy place, most holy place. They leave, presence of God comes back, and it's established at that point. It's not impossible for that to happen. The tabernacle had to be set up and taken down. That had to happen. So there was opportunities for that movement of furniture to take place. I really wrestled with why, but it seems, and if you go back to our context here, it really feels like the author of Hebrews is talking about what happened on the Day of Atonement. So I don't think he got it wrong at all. I think he was really accurate with what the furniture placement was for the Day of Atonement. I really do think he got it right, because that's really what he has in focus here. What he's going to talk about as he gets to verse 6 and following, actually starting at verse 7, is where the high priest went in behind the veil into the most holy place to offer sacrifice, offer sprinkled blood on the Day of Atonement. So if that's what's in view here, I don't think necessarily he got it wrong. So I would say most days, 359 days a year, the setup was, and I could be completely wrong, and if I am, that's fine. Then the guy in Hebrews is too. But I don't think he is. I think he actually got it dead on accurate because of the prescription of how the Day of Atonement is supposed to happen. But 359 days a year, in the holy place outside, there are three pieces of furniture. One day a year, Day of Atonement, there are two pieces outside, two pieces inside the veil. That's my understanding. That's the way I'm understanding what Leviticus 16 says about the actual Day of Atonement. Because I don't see any other way for Aaron to be inside the veil and set the censer onto the fire that's burning before the Lord. Because that's clearly referenced back to the altar of incense. If you read what the altar of incense is going to be, a continual fire burning before the Lord. So that's how I understand that. Again, I haven't necessarily read that any other place. No one else has come up with that. I'm sure that Ron probably doesn't agree, and I'm fine with that. I'm not going to argue about it. What I don't think is that the guy in Hebrews got it wrong. And I think that, for me, that fits. That absolutely fits with what he's talking about here. So beyond that, though, I did say the reason we're going back there is because I said I was going to look at that and try to see if I could figure out why, for me, it mattered. And so that's what I figured out. He goes on to say that as he's describing these things, he says he has the inside of the Ark of the Covenant, there was the Aaron's rod, there was the pot of manna, and there was the tablets of the law. And he describes the furniture in detail. But then he stops. He says, of these things we cannot now speak in detail. And I don't think he means that he didn't have the ability to speak of these things in detail. I think what he's saying is, we don't need to talk about that now. There's no reason to go into a big dissertation on the pieces of furniture in the tabernacle. There's not a reason to do that. So the reason I spent as much time on it was just to try to fix that incongruency with what I've always been taught about the furnishings in the tabernacle and what the author of Hebrews says. When we did Hebrews years and years and years ago, I don't think I even recognized that. This is the first time in studying Hebrews that I said, wait a second, that's not right, is it? And so that's, rather than just blindly accept something, I want to figure out why it might be.
I wouldn't be there the rest of the year.
It's very possible. because that's not the point of the passage, I'm not going to debate it. Because even the guy says, the guy writing Hebrews says, of these things we cannot speak in detail. He doesn't want to lose. He doesn't want to get wrapped around an axle that's not supposed to get wrapped around, because that's not the point. The point is not the furnishings of the tabernacle. The point is that that's where worship took place. That's where these sacrifices took place. And those sacrifices, in a sense, accomplish nothing for a person's conscience. They accomplish nothing as a person's eternal standing before God. There was nothing accomplished there. That's the point. And really, the point is not the furnishings there, but the point is the exclusion. What he's walking through is how people were excluded from God. Because in the holy place, only priests could go in there. If you were not a priest, you were stricken dead by going into the holy place. That's according to Leviticus. Any non-priest that entered into the holy place was to have been stricken dead. And even so, only priests inside the holy place, and beyond that, into the most holy place, or the Holy of Holies, only the high priest, and only on one day a year, and I think four times on that one day a year, the high priest went into the Holy of Holies. That's it. That's the only time ever. And where was the Holy of Holies is where, above the mercy seat, between the cherubim, is where the presence of God dwelt. So to approach, to have access to God, really only one guy in all of Israel had that kind of access to God. And that was the high priest one day a year. And he went in there with fear and trembling. He went in there with fear and trembling. So really what he's doing is laying out the separation from God. And why is that? Why is that? Well, I think the reason he says that, the reason that there was that separation, is because of the ineffectiveness of the sacrificial system. As you read, and he even uses the word here, as you read through Leviticus and you read through this, the offerings that are the burnt offering, the guilt offering, the sin offering, if you read those things, every time it says, then the unintentional sin will be forgiven. The unintentional sin. You just go through and look at every one of the offerings listed in the first seven chapters of Leviticus, and they're all offered for unintentional sin, not for intentional sin. And once he gets past that, he goes even to some of the other, and he says, if you have sinned and you don't realize it, and it comes to your attention that you've sinned, then you go and make an offering. That's the sacrificial system was intended for and designed to take care of only unintentional sin. And even our author says that in verse, I can't find my number, is it still, it's seven. He says, but into the second only the high priest goes, and he but once a year, and not without taking blood, which he offers for himself and for the unintentional sins of the people. That's what the blood sacrifice system did, was took care of unintentional sins. The blood sacrifice never took care of intentional sins. They were taken care of. There was a picture of them taken care of. Sunday morning in Sunday school, Mylene Slavin asked, how do they deal with intentional sin? Well, there's two ways to deal with intentional sin. The first was death. If you violated the law intentionally, you were supposed to be stoned to death. There were serious consequences for willful violation of the law, and it wasn't do a sacrifice and clean yourself up. It was you were supposed to die. Okay. So that is the other way it was taken care of, was through a thing called the scapegoat. The scapegoat, and it's mentioned here when the priest takes two goats. The priest takes two goats. He takes two goats. One goat is going to be killed. Sacrifice, blood's going to be, and he's going to take that blood into the Holy Holies, and he's going to sprinkle that blood on the altar. But there's a second goat. The second goat is the high priest would then, and he would lay his hands on the head of the goat and symbolically transfer the intentional sins of the people from, as a representative of Israel, all the nation, he would transfer the intentional sins of the people to that goat, the scapegoat or the escapegoat, and then Leviticus says, then that goat is to be taken by someone who knows how, or someone who's kind of in charge and knows a good place to take him. He's supposed to be taken and let go free, thereby taking the intentional sins, symbolically taking the intentional sins of the people away forever. What? Well, you don't want that scapegoat that's got the sins of the people on his head coming back. You don't want him showing up. Oh, here I am. Your sins are back. You don't want that happening. So I think we're on agreement on this one, that it's typical they would actually take that goat. They would take it to a cliff. They would break its neck and throw it over. So that goat didn't just get away, didn't get to go free. That goat was killed so he wouldn't come back and bring the sins of the people back. Those are the two ways that intentional sin was dealt with. The scapegoat was a picture of and a looking forward to this time when Jesus, the Messiah, that one promised in Genesis chapter 3, the one looked for throughout all of Israel's history, would come and would officially remove sin completely. And that's what's going to be talked about in verses 11 and following in chapter 9, is Jesus being the one who would fully and completely remove not just unintentional sin, but all sin from the people and from not just Israel, but from everyone. So that's the that's the way that intentional sin was dealt with. But as far as unintentional sin goes, even the sacrificial system was weak in dealing with unintentional sin because it didn't take it away. It didn't remove it. It merely covered it. Again, the word, even the Day of Atonement is not called the Day of Purification. It was never called the Day of Purification. It was not called the Day of Propitiation. It was the Day of Atonement. And atonement, it has the idea of covering, a blood covering, sprinkling with blood to cover the sins of the people, not to remove the sins of the people. There's a big difference in word between atonement and propitiation, a big word, big difference in those two words. So that's really what's being looked at here in these first 10 verses of chapter 9 is the exclusiveness, really, or the difficulty in approaching God under the old system and the ineffectiveness of that old system. And why did the priest have to go in, with fear and trembling? That's a reference back to chapter 4. Remember, chapter 4, he talked about how the high priest has to go with fear and trembling. But now, because of what Jesus did, because the holy place, the most holy place, has been opened wide, we can now boldly come before the throne of grace. We don't have to go in with fear and trembling. We don't have to be afraid of that. But we can come boldly and make our requests and make supplication to God on an individual basis. The door was thrown open wide for all to approach, which is really significant, really important. So there was exclusiveness, or there was difficult to get to God, to be in his presence under the old system. Under the new system, because of what Jesus has done, he's made a way for all to approach, because he went in once, and he went in once not just for himself, he went in once for all and accomplished that gift, that thing. He says, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but verse 14 of chapter 9 says, how much more will the blood of Christ through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God purify our conscience from dead works to serve the living God? So the sacrifice that Jesus offered of himself through the Spirit, that sacrifice accomplished so much more, because it did actually work toward purification of the soul, not just ceremonial cleansing of the outside, the flesh. And that really is what the Old Testament law was about. I'm not making that up. He says that in verse 9, according to the symbolic for this present, according to this arrangement, gifts and sacrifices offered that cannot perfect the conscience of the worshiper, but deal only with food and drink and various washings and regulations for the body imposed until the time of reformation. So he even says that if you look at all of those laws, it was never an intention of that law to purify a conscience. That was never what it was about. The intention of that law was to provide ceremonial ritual, I said the word right at that time, ritual cleanliness for the people. So they could be in a position where they could ritually approach God in a clean way and not defile the things that he says. But according to our author here, that law was never intended as the way for a man to be made pure or a woman to be made pure or a Jew to be made pure. It was never intended for that. It was always intended merely to be used for the outward washings, for the ritual cleansing of food, of houses even, of the body itself, so that one could stand and worship God in whatever capacity he or she was able to do so. So I talked for like just 35 minutes. So anybody got anything they want to say? Except Ron, I'm not going to argue with him. You can say something, but not the altar of incense. I'm not arguing with you about that. John. Yeah, regarding access, I agree with you. I think, and I had planned to go, if you look at access to God, there always seems to have been this cleansing type thing with a point to a fully taken away. Here's what I'm saying. When Adam and Eve sinned, they recognized that they were naked, and they tried to fix it themselves. Their first move was, we'll fix it ourselves. And their first fix themselves was to make themselves leaf clothing. You know, they sewed themselves clothing out of leaves to cover themselves.
So they could
approach God, exactly. So they could in some sense, even then they knew it wasn't working. I think it's interesting that they made themselves coverings, but they knew it didn't work. Because what was their response when God came to visit with them? They hid. They were hiding from him because they knew this ain't working. So when God then finds out, he curses, he does the curse. He offers or he makes them clothing of ram skins. He makes them animal skin clothing. But it's interesting that when he's talking about the future in the curse, he doesn't say to Eve and to Adam, and I'm going to make you these ramskin clothings, and the death of the rams is going to cover, it's going to take care of your problem. He doesn't say that. He doesn't say, and by the way, the death of these rams is going to give you access. Their big issue was, we are naked. We can't approach God in this condition. Why do I say that? Because they didn't hide from each other. They hid from God. So they recognized this problem they have was in a problem in approaching God. So they covered themselves in an attempt to approach God. God says, okay, your leaf coverings aren't working. So then he makes them skin, clothing from skins. Some have suggested that he just, you know, magically sewed some clothing from skin. I don't think so. I think that in the making of clothing from skin, there was death that took place, death of animals, to make those clothes out of skin. I think there had to have been death take place. But again, that gave them, that covered them and gave them some, in some sense, access, but it didn't fix the real problem. It didn't fix the real problem because it wasn't, God didn't say to Eve, and by the way, I'm sewing you these skins so that you can be fine. No, he says to Eve, I will put enmity between your seed and his seed. He will bruise the heel, but the seed will crush Satan's head. That's what he says. Even in that, there is the temporary covering, if you will, to provide some kind of access to God in the death of the rams, but that death of the ram didn't provide taking away. It was the future sacrifice, or the future one who would come and give himself, that's pointed to in Genesis 3:15, that is Jesus, that would be the one that would offer and do the work needed to be done to provide forgiveness for that sin that accomplished there. So even in Genesis, you see, it's kind of neat. You see man's attempt to cover himself, which is always flawed and always fails. You see God's offering of access or making a way for man to have access, but it's all based not on the sacrifice of the goats or whatever it was God used to make the clothes. It was all based on the future sacrifice of the one who would come that would crush the head of the serpent. It was all looking forward to that. That's the same thing that happens throughout the Old Testament. Same thing that happens. Isaiah 53 is an important verse, important chapter, because in Isaiah, the law is already in place. In Isaiah, the people are already doing the law. They're not doing it well. I get that part. But the legal system or the Mosaic law is already in place. The sacrificial system is already set up. And so that's already going on. But when you get to Isaiah 53, that's a chapter that's looking toward the future prophet who will come. And it says he has led the sheep to the slaughter, and it goes through, you know, a great chapter. But it says in Isaiah 53, and by his stripes we're healed. Not by the death of lambs and rams and bulls. That's not how the healing happens. That's how a covering happens. That is not how healing takes place. So even in Isaiah's day, which is 700 years before Jesus, about 700 years, it's almost dead center of where we are now and when Jesus gets here. He's about 740. This is about 1400 BC. So he's sitting right in the middle of those things. And so Isaiah says, you know, even with the sacrificial system happening, that's not taking away sin. That's not healing anything. It's the stripes of the one who would come. It's the sacrifice that he would bear that would provide healing for the nation. So even then, even in that, there's a picture of how this is sacrificial system is pointing to the one who would come and provide that. Even our author in Hebrews here, he says in verse 8, he said, this is, I guess it's 9, which is symbolic for the present age. The actual word there means this is a parable for the present age. The Greek word there is parable, the one we actually translate parable. So he says that the sacrificial system, the Old Testament system, was a parable for where we find ourselves today. And the parable is this. The parable was to show the ineffectiveness of the sacrificial system. Because all it did was provide ritual cleansing of things and of a body and of, I mean, you should be, if you're reading through the Bible chronologically, we're done Leviticus, we're in Numbers now. But if you remember Leviticus, there was, you know, if you get a spot on your skin, I would be outside the camp all the time if I was an Israelite. They would just not even let me inside. Because I got so many blemishes on my skin. I got one right now that would have let me outside they would have made me stay outside for a week. And then the priest would come back and check it again, and he would say, no, if you're not getting in, sorry, you're unclean. Just holler unclean a lot because you got leprosy. But even after you were showed to be non-leprous, you still had to go through this ritual cleansing process. We had to go show yourself to the priest. They go do these ritual washings, these ceremonial washings, and then you could go back. And then once you've accomplished all that, then you were good to be back in, you'd be back in fellowship with the people. Yeah, John. That's Romans 3, 20-something, 25, 26, 27. I don't. I'm pretty sure it's there. Yeah, 3:26. 20:25. I was close. Whom God put forward as propitiation by his blood to receive by faith. This was to show God's righteousness because in his divine forbearance he had passed over former sins. So yeah, Romans 3:25. That's exactly what's kind of at play here. What the Old Testament sacrifices did was they, in effect, covered sins so that God would forbear those sins and not hold people accountable for those sins, based on the future coming sacrifice of his son. But it was all based on what Jesus would do. So an Old Testament believer, an Old Testament Jewish believer or Gentile believer, anyone who believed God, it was never law keeping that accomplished their salvation. It was always faith. Abraham is justified by faith. That's what Genesis says. That's what Romans says. That's not what James says, although James is not saying that Abraham justified. James is saying that the way that Abraham's faith was demonstrated was by the works that he did, which is actually really in line with what the guy in Hebrews is going to say in Hebrews 11 when he talks about how, you know, faith always works. Every example of faith that he's going to use in Hebrews 11 is not a person who just believed, but a person who had faith and did something because of that faith. Real faith has real action. That's just a fact. But if there's no faith, then action doesn't matter. Action doesn't matter. No matter how hard, you know, again, no matter how hard you try to fix yourself, it's not going to happen. And what this shows, what the Old Testament law showed was for unintentional sin, nothing was ever done cleanse a person's conscience. If you had leprosy, if you had a baby, if a woman had a baby, there was a period of time when she was unclean, and then she'd go through this ceremony, this ritual cleansing. It's a word I cannot say for some reason. This ritual cleansing that would get her where she could get back into and do things again. That's why, you know, when you get to the woman with the issue of blood in the New Testament that had that issue of blood for years and years and years and years and years, that made her unclean. That means she couldn't have any kind of even close relationship with her family. That's why it was really such a big deal that she was dealing with this thing. But even then, nothing ever cleaned the conscience. It was all about cleaning your house, cleaning your dishes, cleaning your clothes, cleaning your body, but never was it designed to clean the conscience. It was never designed for that. The only thing ever designed that would clean the conscience was the death of Jesus and the blood he offered in our place. That's what cleans the conscience. So this parable, this Old Testament parable, the Old Covenant parable, is a parable that shows how desperately we needed someone to make us right, because the Old Testament law was never designed to do that. Never designed to do that. Even Old Testament prophets say that. Isaiah says that was not what the intention of the law was. The intention of the law was not so that Israel could become holy. The intention of the law was to show how great God was, and that all the nations would see Israel loving God with all their heart, soul, strength, and mind, loving their neighbor as themselves, and they would be established as a city on a hill. And that light then would draw all men to a recognition that God is the only God and there's no other God worthy of worship. That's what the law was designed to do. It was not a design to provide righteousness in any way. Never designed that to do that. In fact, even God knows that as you get to Deuteronomy, when they've gone through, he's given them the law. At the end of that sermon, they go and do the blessings and cursings. And God says in that sermon, if you obey, I'll do this. But when you don't, I'll curse you. So even then, there's a hint that this is not doable. Galatians makes it really clear. Paul in Galatians makes it really clear that by the keeping of the law, no flesh is justified in his sight. The law keeping never justifies anybody in the sight of God. What justifies us? The resurrection of Jesus. That's what justifies us. Paul in Romans says he was delivered for our offenses and raised for our justification. That's what justifies us. We can't justify ourselves. Can't do it. And the great news is we don't have to. We don't have to because Jesus already did for those who believe. It was accomplished. His blood offered by himself in the real holy place, not the picture holy place, not the symbolic holy place, in the real holy place, most holy place. That blood offered once for all is what provides justification. That's what meets the need. That's what provides total access for everyone. And so while the old covenant was restrictive in its access to God, this new covenant is wide open. It's wide open. There is no barrier. There is no longer, the way Paul talks about it, there's no longer Jew or Greek. There's no longer slave. He's broken down the middle wall of partition. I love that. The middle wall of partition. It's really a middle curtain of partition, but it's okay. He broke it down. There's significance in the fact that as Jesus died, as Jesus gave up his spirit, the earthquake happens, and the veil, that curtain that separated, that curtain was ripped from top to bottom. There's significance there. And that's an indication that it was not anything that man could ever do. It was only through the blood of Jesus offered that one time, at that time, on our behalf, that opened the door wide open, threw it wide open for us to be able to come in. And so that's a real difference between the old and new covenant. Now, we have grown up, new covenant mentality, right? We've grown up with that idea. I mean, maybe not as, you know, I've been in church since I was like 3 days old. So I've grown up with it. Some folks, have come to faith later in life. I get that. But when you've come to faith, it's never been because you were keeping Israel's law first and then gotten here. So this might be, yeah, I get it. Okay, Brian, let go of it, man. Just stop. But if you understand his audience, who he's writing to, these are people who have grown up. What is normal for them, especially these Hebrews that he's writing, what is normal for them is that law. And that law has driven them. Some of these, the examples they have of people who are getting it right in their mind are the Pharisees. In their mind, the people who are getting it right are the Pharisees. These guys who are pious. These guys who are law-keeping. These guys who, you know, wrap the phylacteries around their wrists and wrap the phylacteries around their head. These guys who do give alms for the poor. These guys who, that's the picture of getting it right for these folks. And what this author is saying is, no, they are getting it wrong. Because what they're doing doesn't ever cleanse their conscience. What they're doing doesn't ever cleanse their soul. What they're doing, all it provides for them is this ritual cleansing of clothes and cups. And Jesus even points to that when he talks to them about how you clean the outside of the cup, but you leave the inside filthy. And that's exactly the point being made here, is all that Old Testament, all that law, all that ritual, all it did was clean the outside of the cup. And left the inside nasty. You know, Jesus even makes the point even better when he tells them, woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites. You're like whitewashed sepulchers. You look really good on the outside. Really good on the outside. But inside, you're full of dead men's bones. So the Old Testament law was never to accomplish that. And that's a hard thing. That would be a hard thing for these Jewish guys who have lived their life in that kind of mentality. It would be a hard thing just to throw off and say, okay, I believe that. I'll quit. No, that would be really, really hard for them to do. It would be, this is a huge jump for them. That's why he's using so much Old Testament scripture to back up this New Testament idea. That's why he used Jeremiah talking about this new covenant, because it's not a new thing. It's not something that Jesus made up. You know, this is not something Jesus made up just 20 years. Hebrews is written probably about 53, 55 AD. So Jesus has been, you know, gone for 25 years. But what Jesus is teaching, according to the Old Testament scriptures, is not a new thing. This is not a 25-year-old understanding. This is a ancient understanding. Come clear back in Genesis, all through the law, through Isaiah, through Jeremiah. This new covenant idea is not a 25-year-old idea. He hasn't left us alone, and he hasn't left us uninformed. I think that's also important to recognize. He didn't leave us uninformed. He didn't just say, well, you know, figure it out. Here's new news. You know, he didn't do that. He pointed to that all throughout the Old Testament. He pointed to the fact that even this sacrificial system that he established wasn't intended to remove sin. It was intended to provide access. It was intended to provide ritual access for a people, just like the rams that he sacrificed in the garden. Just like those rams provided access for people, that's what the law did, but it did not provide clear conscience. It did not purify sin. There's a big difference between access and purity. Big difference. There was ritual cleansing in the law, but not purification of the soul. John? Exactly. David understood that. I think that, you know, I don't think what Nathan says to David as he confronts him is accidental. David gets what should happen to him for the sin he committed. He gets that. And David, you know, is contrite. He's broken. And when Nathan says to him, you're the guy, and he tells him the story about the little lamb and all that. And David's just furious with the guy. Let's go find him and kill him. And Nathan looks at David and says, you're the guy. And David recognizes he's cut. The first thing out of Nathan's mouth is, yeah, you've sinned, but God's not going to kill you. God's not going to kill you. I think fully David expected the right response from God to his sin would be killing. So how is that just? How is it just for God not to kill David? Just for God not to kill David, because even killing David wouldn't have taken care of David's sin. That's not how it would have been taken care of, because David's sin was not unintentional. David's sin with Bathsheba was an intentional thing. Even if you give him the unintentional sin with Bathsheba, you can't give him murdering Uriah as unintentional. That's clearly a plan. I get, you know, he's just walking on his roof when kings are supposed to go out to war. He stays home. He's walking on his roof. He just happens to look and see Bathsheba, and maybe the truck gets going and he can't get it stopped. Okay, I think that's silly. But you know, there are some who wouldn't give him that. That was unintentional. But when he made the plan to stick Uriah at the front of the lines, and even Joab says, he'll die. And David says, yeah, do it anyway. Basically, I want him dead. That's intentional. And so would David's death have fixed David's conscience? Would it have purified his soul? The answer to that's no. Would not have. The only thing that would ever purify David's soul was the coming Messiah. David got that. David got that in his psalm, in his prayer, Psalm 51. You're not going to delight in sacrifices. You're not going to delight in burnt offerings. If that was the case, I'd offer them. But the sacrifice that you do delight in, the sacrifice you won't despise, is a broken and contrite heart. That's how David approaches God. And it's interesting. After he approaches God with a broken and contrite heart, then he offers sacrifices of praise. He gets it. He gets the horse where it needs to be and puts the cart behind it. Doesn't offer sacrifice to gain God's favor first. He offers a broken and contrite heart that God won't despise, and then he offers sacrifice. So there's a big difference. So anyway, that's what the first 10 verses of Hebrews 9 is all about. in my estimation. So we'll get to the the sacrifice that did provide clear conscience. We'll do that in 3 weeks, March 18th.